Today's operation is the frustration of Vietnam in miniature.
I shall not see.
The worst area we've been in since I've been in Vietnam. Awful sick, and I'll be so glad to go home.
And I will not accept.
As men clamored over one another, pushing aside women and children in their panic-stricken fury, members of the air crew dragged them onto the plane, trying to fill it as fast as possible.
The nomination of my party for another term as your president.
For it seems now more certain than ever that the bloody experience of Vietnam is to end in a stalemate.
This is Dr. Stephen Nurse. These episodes of Is Abled focus on the brave men and women who fought in the Vietnam War, not the politics that surrounded the war. This is The War in Vietnam, Part 2. Those who were there are still fighting because the jungle changes a man. Hello, this is Dr. Steve Nurse, and this is our second series on Vietnam. And in this series, we've interviewed more vets. Our focus on this second series has been, again, to get the personal experiences and not necessarily the political philosophies. But since this is our second series, I thought it would be a good idea to not point fingers at governments or people or anything else, but every experience that we have in life, we learn something to do, and we probably also learn something not to do. I always told my students, when I had graduate students at Central Washington University, that I always, when I was growing up, I always knew what the right thing to do was. I didn't always do the right thing, but I always knew the right thing to do was. And so I think that we can learn from history. I hope we can learn from history. So I have with me today Mike Dorsey, who was a friend of mine from high school and has also done some interviews, and Zach Krieger, who is from Vashon, has been here for quite a while, also a Vietnam veteran. He was in artillery, and Mike was in helicopters and was in infantry. And so I'd like to do today is just to have kind of a round table. Actually, it's only, I guess it would be, and also we have Rick Ames. So I guess we do have kind of a, it's more of a square table than a round table, but, I got to use the appropriate words. I'd like to talk a little bit about what we've learned from Vietnam going forward, and especially with Rick, since he's weathered all of these interviews with me on many Saturdays, things that he's learned or things that have stuck with him from some of the interviews that we've had. So why don't we start out with Zach first? And Zach, just tell me a little bit about, your experience in Vietnam and what did you come out of Vietnam coming back to the United States? What were your thoughts?
Well, I was there in 1968 during the Tet Offensive. So it was a period when the fighting was pretty intense. The number of Americans, soldiers killed every week was, I think, probably the highest of the war. And I think coming back, for me, it was just this enormous sense of relief to just be alive, because I think what I learned through that experience of going into the Army and then going to Vietnam was really the preciousness of life. And I learned that it's trite, it's obvious to say it, but I think it takes a while to learn it, that without life, there's nothing. And so that's really what's on the line in war. And so for me, I guess the main thing was just the learning the, in a very profound way, the preciousness of life. And coming back from Vietnam, just being so thankful that that I was not killed or badly wounded. And going forward from that, it was the idea that at least some part of my life would be about trying to prevent war. In obviously an individual can do very little, but I felt that very strongly.
Good, yeah. I think that the one thing that I've, again, letting people know that I'm not a vet, but I think the one thing that I kind of realize every day is such a thin line between, you know, things can happen so fast. Usually, if you're in a situation like Vietnam and you're in, you know, in a war zone, much higher chance of something happening. But then you hear somebody, you know, driving down the street in a windstorm, and a tree falls on their car, and it's just, you know, you have to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. But just really how fragile life is, and how precious it is, and also from my perspective, having had a disability that was pretty major at pretty early time in my life, at 22, I really do consider every day that I'm alive, except some of the days that I spend with Rick. Other than that, no, that's not true. But really, really a blessing. Really, really something to appreciate. And I try to say to myself, I don't have time to be mad at stupid things. You know, that's kind of one of the things that I've learned. Mike, how about you? What have we learned?
Oh, boy. That's a lot to grab right there. I was just listening to you guys talk. I was just thinking of how kind of the experience of being, my experience was, I became conscious of this, kind of the flow of things, I guess you'd say, but once you get hooked up into the military like that and pushed into a combat zone, which is a very different environment than anything else. How should we say this? That when you get pushed into it to the point where you're now up against these other people, you know, you really, the single-minded focus of your existence is to stay alive and to do whatever it takes to stay alive. And if that includes having to mortally injure, kill whatever, someone else, that becomes perfectly acceptable. That is what you're going to do. But you don't do it by virtue of it is your desire to graduate from high school and go through training and get out there and, you know, get blood and guts all over you. It's a position. You're pushed into this position, and where you will do what you will do whenever it takes, when that real fear sinks in and you realize what's happening, what you have to do. And I didn't, and interestingly, the other side is in the same position. So we've got all these people in this
room. Sure. I mean, it's kind of the thing is, again, I'm just, you know, talking concepts, but, you know, in a war or let's say something like Ukraine, it's kind of like, you know, who can create the hardest hardship and the worst damage on another army or people or whatever is the one that wins. So it seems like you don't, in war, you can't have a win-win. You know, you, and generally, I think, as I've thought about it more, it's more of a loss-loss, you know, whoever has the least. Rick, what do you think about from hearing all these interviews? What have you picked up that kind of in general that, I don't know if it's in general, I mean, everybody's had a unique story.
Well, everybody seems to be on the same page when it comes to this is a terrible way to solve problems. Having a war, there, like you said, there's no win-win. There's no win-lose because the winners often pay a terrible price as well.
Yeah,
and there's just got to be a better way to deal with it. And I don't know how to implement that better way.
Yeah, I mean, it's you're right. I mean, it's like they're saying now that Ukraine is, you know, is in some cases pushing back. You know, they've maybe retaken some, you know, one city or something. But what have you retaken? I mean, you look at the city and it's blown apart. You know, all the, you know, places where people live are blown apart. They're saying that, you know, all these very important, at least the people there, are these religious, you know, churches and buildings and things, sites have been destroyed. And I just have a hard time thinking that anybody's winning. Are there any good things that ever came out of something like Vietnam? Do you think, Zach, that we have learned some things and we've done some things differently?
Well, I think at the level, national level, the level of politics and policy and strategy, in a major way, I think, no, we've not learned anything. And I say that because I recently read a book called The Afghanistan Papers. And it was written by a reporter from the Washington Post. And it was very much like, and I'm sure he chose the title intentionally, sort of like the Pentagon Papers. But when you look at Afghanistan and think about it in terms of Vietnam, so much of it was exactly the same. That is, the amount of deceit on the part of our national government and of the military leaders and their unwillingness to tell the truth about what was going on. I mean, it was, to me, it seems so similar that I have to conclude that at that level, I don't think we've learned much.
Mm-hmm.
I won't try.
Maybe we learn how to spin things better. Maybe that's it. But I know that that Mike's son is in the military, and he's in Afghanistan, right?
No,
he's not there now, but I mean, he
just got back from Iraq.
Iraq, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
But
and again, I think it seems like sometimes we go into these wars thinking that they're going to be very short-lived, you know, remember when we went into Iraq the first time, and what was the word? Awe and
shock and awe.
Shock,
yeah,
and awe.
Shock and awe. And that it was, and we had these, we watched these things, and I felt kind of almost bad because I thought, you know, I'm on the good guy's side, and, you know, Saddam Hussein is the bad guy, and we're really getting him. Look at all these, we're watching on TV, these bombs are blowing up, and, you know, we watch a drone bomb go right down the chimney of the, you know, one of their big buildings. And it's interesting how I get that perspective that I'm on the good guy's side, you know. God's on my side. You know, we kind of picture it that way. What do you think, Mike? Do you think the wars are going to be short and they're always long? I mean, I didn't think we thought we'd be in Vietnam that long.
Do I think God picks sides?
Yeah.
That's another one.
Yeah.
You know, I was going to say, I thought we learned that it, on a national scale, military scale, to be very circumspect about entering into military engagements with people based on the, you know, what do you call it, post-Vietnam syndrome, as they say.
Right.
The military is like, no more Vietnams. You know, we're not going to get into a quagmire. And then we went into Afghanistan and Iraq. And I was very reluctant to say, I guess we haven't learned anything. But, you know, the evidence is not clear that really...
Well, it's
interesting. We have learned anything.
And we always thought, I kind of remember even thinking, and I was a kid, and I was, you know, naive, but I thought, well, World War II, well, and that's going to be our last big war, you know. Well,
I would agree with that.
It wasn't. There hasn't been a time when we haven't had wars.
True, but
they
were just little wars.
Yeah, that's right.
Very contained.
Or we called them police actions. Or we called them conflicts.
Sure.
You know, we, people don't die, they pass away, you know. I think we spin these things from a pretty interesting perspective. Rick, any thoughts on that?
Well, the one positive thing that you can find is gained at great cost, but there are some medical advances that take place as a result of caring for the wounded people, both evacuation and immediate trauma care. Some things like that have they probably would have taken place anyway, but you know, the war expedited some of that stuff, and it's not worth it, but it's
And we did learn too that you know, that that first 15 minutes or whatever it did, you know, I mean, it's like they were saying in World War II, to get somebody back to a, you know, to some kind of a first aid base or a station, you know, it took X number of time. And then Korean War, we used helicopters, MASH, and and so, you know, now we have learned a lot of things like that. And I guess that, like you say, it's not the best way to learn it. Let me ask you this question, Zach, because I think there's a big change in how we deal with war, in that we keep building bigger and better bombs, I guess, is, you know, for lack of a better way. And in some ways, war is more personal in that, you know, we have a war in Ukraine and there's 8,000 people there with cell phones watching a building explode. At the same time, it's impersonal in that you can send a drone up and drop something right down the chimney, you know? Thoughts on that? That's a lot to chew, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I guess I would say you can, you know, you can talk about these different technologies and so forth, but I think that in the end, it's just all about suffering, and that's not changed, and I don't think it will change until, you know, there's some kind of a universal consensus against war.
Yeah, I think that's a good, I mean, I really think that's a probably one of the most, that's a great statement that it's all about suffering. It really is, isn't it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It is, you know, look at the Civil War. The Civil War. More people killed in the Civil War than any war in this country by many more people. And it was about suffering. And it was about injuries. And it was about, you know, we, like I said, we talked about World War II. And if you've ever seen the movie Coming, you know, what's it, Saving Private Ryan. And some of the vets have said that that's some of the most authentic depiction of what it was like to come onto Normandy Beach. And, you know, and it was all about suffering. And, you know, the letter back home and the MPs coming up to the house. How do you think it's changed, Mike?
Well, you know, there's a great deal more information available on a immediate basis about things now. I think traditionally the, I don't know how to say it, but kind of the wars were lightly covered. You get a oh, we've taken this, we've taken that, you know, it, not day-to-day-to-day actual damage, actual people, you know, it's more big things. So now that's not the case. Everybody's got a camera, everybody's broadcasting, so you can see it. The whole thing in Ukraine could easily, 40 years, have been explained away as a minor incursion and blah, 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 so much damage, but and it's kind of done.
Like Russians went into Czechoslovakia.
Exactly.
You know, I remember seeing that at the Liberty Theater, a little, you know, when they had the newsreels at the movie theaters. You know, you'd have your Tom and Jerry cartoon and then the newsreels. And and it was like, I remember it said, I actually remember that. You know, Russian tanks are rolling into, you know, Czechoslovakia and this other stuff. And
right, but you didn't hear day by day by day.
And it wasn't close either. It wasn't just the fact that it was, you know, black and white TV and it was, you know, far, far away. You know, it hadn't, you know, I thought it certainly didn't have any relationship to me in Ellensburg. And, what do you think, Zach? What do you?
I guess I don't understand what your question is, really.
That's a good point because I don't think I ask it very well.
I mean,
but
there's much more information now, and that's for sure, and but. Yeah, and I remember. I think I was in Vietnam when the Russians went into Czechoslovakia, and I wouldn't have had a sense of what was on TV at that time, but I know that a few weeks ago I read a column in the New York Times by one of the columnists, the guy named Tom Friedman, who was saying that he thought all the social information networks that we have going now, that they were really going to change the way the world thinks of what Russia has is doing. That in other words, that Putin would put the lid on all the information if he could.
Sure.
What Tom Friedman, I think, was saying is that because of the information technology that is so pervasive now, he can't do it.
Yeah.
Nothing he can do to keep the people of Ukraine from telling the world what's happening.
And what's even more important, I think, is he can't keep the people of Ukraine from telling people in Russia what's really happening. You know, he could at some point kind of keep the lid on everything in Russia, but he really can't even do that. I mean, it's like we first kind of saw some of that type of media in Tiananmen Square when people could get pictures out and things very quickly. And I heard this very interesting statement. It said that, you know, when President Kennedy was assassinated and we had one film, the Zapruder tape, you know, that shows Kennedy going down there and, mm-hmm. you know, getting hit and all that stuff. It said, and, you know, we were trying to figure out, well, did it come from this angle or did it come from the, you know, this building or that building? I mean, if that had happened now, we would have... There would have been 8,000. I mean, that's
an triangulated.
Yeah. You know, even now, even things in Seattle, they say if you go to Seattle and you spend a day or have lunch or do whatever, you know, or any major city, your image is probably recorded on anywhere from 30 to 40, even more, cameras. I mean, how many of these things do you see that? Somebody going into Target and buying a shovel, and the next thing you know, they're charged with some kind of murder or something. And mm-hmm. and I think it is that that immediacy. And I find it kind of contradictory that in some ways war is very much closer to us, and in other ways it's really, really far apart because it's not, you know, it's not hand-to-hand combat like it used to be.
Oh, it is.
It is, yeah.
Actually, it always is. That's yeah. the bottom line. That's what the war is about.
That's kind of the end cleanup part of it, I guess, maybe. Or...
Yeah. Well, that's one of the things I learned when I was in the infantry was that no war is won without somebody has to close one-on-one and deal with this person-to-person. That's the bottom line. So, and that's the way it always is, big war, small war, or whatever. And that's very, that was very uncomfortable for me to learn that. I wonder that maybe this, the fact of social media and immediate information and pictures of what's happening might in fact be the saving grace on warlike behavior because you can't hide it. And just make weekly reports. There's pictures of buildings blown apart, people murdered. I mean, that is what war is about. It's about murder, death, and destruction on a wholesale basis. And that's what it's about. That's how you win.
Yeah.
That's the bottom line. And it's more intellectual discussion for those of us who aren't involved in it. If you're involved in it, it's extremely personal. Extremely personal. If you're 10,000 miles away, you know, and removed. It's more intellectual exercise.
And I wonder, I always think about this, you know, and I would never compare the Holocaust to anything else. I understand that. But at the same time, I wonder if we would have acted differently if we had known about it sooner, because most of those horrific black and white videos of, you know, bodies in piles and things really didn't come out until, I don't think it really came out until after the war. We heard, you know, mm-hmm. recalls and stuff, but anyhow, well, let's just mm-hmm. hope that we do get, things do improve and God bless everybody that's out there doing stuff. And I certainly... want to send something out to Ukraine and hope that they get this thing solved quickly. I don't, other than that, I really don't care. I just want it solved.
I'm with you.
And so thank you very much, Zach.
Thank you for your efforts in this this whole series, Steve. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
But it is increasingly clear to this report that the only rational way out then will be to negotiate, not as victors, but as an honorable people who lived up to their pledge to defend democracy and did the best they could.
April 30th, 1975 was the official end of the war in Vietnam. But to say it was the end of the war would not be giving all those who participated their earned respect. The collateral damage continues and causes suffering to this day. Dr. Steve Nurse, signing off.